listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference is slated to begin at the end of the month in Paris. The goal is to reach a legally binding agreement from all nations of the world to address climate change.
The conference comes at the end of a year that's on track to be the hottest yet. Leaders from around the globe have already made commitments on their own to cut carbon emissions. And this year, the Pope released an unprecedented encyclical dedicated to combating climate change.
Here with us now is Tim Flannery. He is Australia's former chief climate commissioner, and he's the author of the new book, Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
About a decade ago, you published the book, The Weathermakers. It drew public attention to this issue, climate change. Back then, not as widely acknowledged as it is today. How have perceptions of climate change changed in the intervening years?
Well, you know, I remember a decade ago when I was traveling around the U.S. and indeed the world talking about climate change. I had to show a series of graphs, you know, scientific graphs of CO2 rising and that sort of thing. I don't have to do that anymore because most people now know climate change from direct lived experience. Wherever I go, people know that the heat waves and the megafires and the changes they're seeing in their climate are related to this increased burden of greenhouse gases. So that's a great step forward, actually. It gives us a firm foundation for action when the community basically knows what's happening.
And that's a point you make right off the bat in your book, that we're not talking about a hypothetical thing 50 years from now. We're living in a climate-changing world right now.
We certainly are. And, you know, people in the U.S. know this as well as anybody. You know, on the East Coast, up in the New England area, you've had a huge increase in rainfall intensity. So, you know, rain that used to fall gently and over a longer time now falls in big clumped masses, and it tends to overwhelm drainage infrastructure, sewers and so forth. In the southwest, you've had historic droughts, things that have never been seen the likes of in the 500 years that Europeans have been living in that area. And, of course, up in the north and in other areas, forested areas, you've seen huge forest fires. So there are big, large-scale changes right across the country, really, which people now, I think, understand the origins of.
People say, though, hey, look, in the winter we still have snow, and with these extreme events you're talking about, it's hard to draw a direct line saying this specific event was caused by climate change. Is it hard to overcome those perceptions?
There's still a small group of people. In Australia, it's about 6 or 7% of the population who just reject all evidence. And they're the sort of people who will never change their mind anyway, no matter what evidence you put before them. But the rest of the community is more thoughtful than that. And, you know, the science has advanced as well. It used to be the case that we didn't have a method that allowed us to slate home responsibility for a single weather event to the greenhouse gases, the human greenhouse gases. But that's changed. You know, last year in Australia, we have a thing called the Australian Tennis Open. It's in my home city of Melbourne. And we had to cancel play at that Open a year ago because 1,000 spectators had to be treated for heat stress. It was above 50 degrees in the main stadium, and these were unprecedented conditions.
That's Celsius.
Scientists did an analysis. That's right. It's very hot. So scientists did an analysis of the weather patterns at that time. And they did a series of computer runs saying, would this have ever happened without the human-caused greenhouse gases? And it turns out the chances were about 1 in 12,000 that it would happen naturally. It was much, much more likely to happen when you add in the influence of the human-caused greenhouse gases. So the science is now, at least in some circumstances, allowing us to say, well, this definitely would not have happened without the human impact on the climate system.
How about efforts to tackle this problem? What do you make of what national leaders, international leaders have done in the 10 years since your previous book came out?
Well, for 8 of those years, I was pretty depressed. You know, I played a role at Copenhagen. I was chairing the Copenhagen Climate Council for 3 years, and we really hoped for better out of that first meeting. But to be honest with you, for the last decade, the world has been on the worst-case scenario emissions trajectory for greenhouse gases. So it's as bad as anyone could have imagined it would have been. Things are just starting to change. You know, in the lead-up to Paris now, we've seen Governments commit unilaterally to reduce emissions, and it looks like the Paris meeting will get us off that worst-case scenario trajectory where we were heading for 4 degrees of warming by the end of the century, onto a trajectory that's closer to 2.7 degrees of warming by 2100. Now, that's still way, way too warm, but at least we are starting to see now the beginnings of change, I think.
Talking to Tim Flannery about his new book, Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. Well, most of your book, Tim, focuses on solutions. Let's get to that now. First, you mentioned cutting emissions. That seems to be a starting point. In this upcoming conference, end of this month into December, do you think there will be solid commitments that actually make a difference in carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions?
Look, I do think so. You know, we have tried and failed to have a legally binding treaty, a top-down approach, and I was never that keen on them anyway, to be honest with you. You know, we saw with the Kyoto Protocol that Canada didn't live up to its obligations and should have paid $1 billion in fines, but there was no blue helmet seen north of the border there in Canada to try to get the money back. You know, the enforcement for these legal treaties isn't great. But if nations set their own targets, it looks pretty bad when you fail a test that you've set yourself, you know? And so there is hope, I think, that these targets will be honoured. Countries have set them with full knowledge of their economy and how they work, and they're going into this meeting with goodwill, bolstered by the view that other people are doing similar things and that this can all be achieved.
Is that going to be enough? If countries set those legally binding emissions agreements, is it going to do enough to keep those carbon levels down to an acceptable level?
Well, look, the sad fact is that there's enough greenhouse gas already in the air to raise global temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average. And at those sort of levels, you know, the Great Barrier Reef just won't survive. It won't be there. So we're dealing with this very, very late. You know, as I said, the cumulative emissions will keep temperatures around below 2.7 degrees. We really need to be below 2 degrees if we want to have a stable climate future. So we need other tools. And that's what my book's really about, outlining these other tools, the third-way technologies that can draw CO2 out of the atmosphere at scale.
And let's get into that now. There's a lot of things I hadn't heard of before I read the book, Tim. These third-way ideas to get, as you say, the carbon out of the atmosphere. One is taking a common mineral, olivine, I don't know how to pronounce it, and using it for lots of things. Tell us about that. Oop, we've lost Tim Flannery. We're talking to Tim Flannery about solutions to climate change. He's the author of the new book, Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. He's Australia's former chief climate commissioner. This all comes on the eve of a major international conference hosted by the UN, trying to get specific emissions commitments from every country on Earth, if possible, to cut emissions. In just a few moments, we'll talk to Tim about ideas, alternatives to solve the problem.
And we'll continue the conversation, maybe hearing from you when you call 800-642-1234. Do you think the United States is taking appropriate action to combat climate change? Should we do more? Should we do less? What do you think about the prospect of a universal agreement on climate change? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Tim Flannery, Australia's former chief climate commissioner and author of the new book, Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. At the end of the month, all members of the United Nations will meet to try to reach a legally binding agreement on climate change for every country on Earth.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about climate change? What do you think about the idea of geoengineering the planet to stem climate change? Or we're going to talk about now capturing carbon from the air. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Tim, talk about this idea of capturing carbon and maybe even using it.
Well, I was skeptical initially of the possibility of capturing carbon at a significantly large scale and then putting it somewhere or using it, that we could affect the climate system. But I've become involved with a thing called the Virgin Earth Challenge, which is a £25 million prize that Richard Branson has put up to foster technologies that can do precisely that. And there's been 11,000 entries into that prize. And so some of them really show astonishing potential. You know, basically in two streams. You know, one stream is called the biological, and that involves everything from reforestation to the development of biochar and onto seaweed farms, which strangely hold a very large potential. And then the chemical processes, which involve things like carbon-negative concretes, which are very new on the market. They're concretes that absorb CO2, as they said, onto plastics made from atmospheric CO2, or even carbon fibres made from atmospheric carbon dioxide. And there's certain rocks that you can grind up, and as they weather, they will absorb carbon dioxide as well. So there's a huge range of possibilities out there. And my best guess was that by 2050, they could be drawing out about 40% of the current emissions that we put up into the atmosphere every year.
But we'd have to do these things on a really large scale to have them make a difference, wouldn't we?
That's right. We're talking about the gigaton scale here. And just to give you a sense of that, last year we put 40 gigatons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. If you wanted to take one-tenth of that out, so 4 gigatons out, using reforestation or tree planting, for example, you'd need to plant a forest over an area the size of Australia, which is almost as big as the contiguous 48 states of the USA. And that would give you that 4 gigatons on average. But, you know, you think about the scale of that, it clearly reforestation can do a small bit of the job, but we've got to find other tools that can also do something.
Let's go to one of our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is on the line in Milwaukee. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. For one, the geoengineering thing, I'm a truck driver, and I watch them spraying this stuff all day long, every day. That's not helping anything. In my opinion, it's making things worse.
I'm sorry, Jeremy, spraying?
Spraying what? I don't know what they're spraying up there, but they're spraying something. And I can, you know, when I was younger, you didn't see these trails going all the way across the sky from horizon to horizon.
Jeremy, I think Jeremy may be confusing those airplane vapor trails, but he's not wrong. There has been talk, Tim, of adding things like, I think, sulfur into the atmosphere to try to reduce greenhouse gases. You're not a fan of that idea, right?
That's right. And one idea is you mix a bit of sulfur in jet fuel and you can dull the Earth's atmosphere, and therefore a lot of light will get reflected back into space. I think they're dangerous ideas because they don't deal with the underlying problem of the overabundance of CO2, which is acidifying our oceans and causing other changes. And they're really like a Band-Aid solution on a very festering wound, you know. And once you take the Band-Aid off or it pops off, you can have very dramatic change. And, you know, if for some reason sulfur wasn't continued to be sprayed, we could have the climate system rebound and react in very odd ways. So I think basically they're a bad idea. But I do think that the slower third-way technologies, even though they're slower, are better in the longer term because they help strengthen Earth's own system of self-regulation. You know, they either mimic the way the natural system draws CO2 out or enhance that. And that's a fundamentally sound way to go about dealing with the problem, I think. The difficulty is, of course, that many of these technologies are at a very nascent stage, a very, very early stage of development, and it's going to be 10, 20, 30 years before the scale that we need.
But you make the case in your book that technology can improve quickly if we start trying it now. So you're hoping to see a lot of at least pilot projects in this third-way carbon capture technology?
Indeed, and I think there's a huge opportunity there because these technologies are so broad-based across the economy that they're going to have massive impacts. And, you know, we've already seen a number of booms. We're seeing the tech boom, the clean tech boom, and, you know, they've propelled economies. And this boom will be bigger than those. And we know that it's going to have to be used because that CO2 is not going to disappear out of the atmosphere of its own accord. We're going to have to work to draw it out. And, of course, some of these technologies will be highly profitable. I mean, making carbon nanofibers from atmospheric CO2 at a fraction of the cost of current production methods, as has just been shown, that's a fantastic technological advance. The country that masters that is going to be competing head-on with steel production and aluminium production for a huge share of the market when it comes to building structures, cars, planes, whatever.
And a lot of these ideas are not hypothetical. You talk about a roofing company, I think it is, in Europe that is using one of the minerals you mentioned to create a carbon-catching rooftop.
Well, that's right. I mean, the heartening thing is that at a small scale, a lot of these technologies have already been demonstrated. So the Dutch roofing company you're talking about is great. I mean, they take a rock pour serpentinite, which is very common in parts of the Earth's crust, grind it up, mix it with their roof paint, and as it weathers on your roof, it captures carbon dioxide. That's a pretty neat trick. You know, some people are thinking about seeding whole beaches with that crushed up rock so that as the waves go back and forth and the rock erodes, it'll be capturing CO2 at a very large scale. The downside of it is, of course, that we use fossil fuels to crush up, to quarry and crush up rocks currently. We've got to get away from that and find cleaner ways of really powering some of these chemical third-way technologies.
Talking to Tim Flannery, author of the book Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. And Tim, another solution you keyed in on that's being tried, and I want to expand on a little, the idea of using a seaweed to combat climate change, to absorb carbon. What is out there? What stage is that in now?
Well, you know, the funny thing is seaweed is one of those technologies with the greatest potential, but very typically it's the one that's least developed. Seaweed is great stuff because it grows at 30 to 60 times the speed of land-based plants, so it can capture lots of CO2 very quickly. One desktop study suggested if we could cover 9% of the world's ocean in seaweed farms, you could draw down all of current annual emissions of carbon dioxide and also grow enough fish and other seafood under those seaweed farms to feed, give 200 kilograms of protein to a population of 10 billion every year. And that's because the seaweed buffers the ocean. It makes it less acid and it becomes a very favourable environment for growing oysters and prawns and fish and whatever else. So that's some of that technology is in place. You know, there's 500 square kilometres of seaweed farms off the coast of China now, so we know how they work. The problem is when you're growing seaweed at that scale and you want to capture the carbon out of it, how do you do that? How do we use that seaweed? You know, we don't want piles of seaweed clogging up the world's oceans, but, you know, so we've got to find a way to use that seaweed and then to store the CO2 from it.
I want to get into one more thing on the problem side of things here. Ocean, you just mentioned it, acidification. How big a worry should that be for us as we think about climate change?
Look, to me, that is one of the great sleeping issues. You know, ocean acidification was only really recognised in the early 2000s, and it's only in the last couple of years that scientists have developed methodologies for studying it properly. But it's not a sort of a hypothetical problem. It's a very concrete problem. You can go to parts of the sea floor where there's volcanic vents that are putting CO2 into the atmosphere, and you can see the impacts, and they're pretty catastrophic. They have a very severe impact on a lot of organisms. And we're only now beginning to study the life cycle of organisms to a degree where we understand how big those impacts can be. One example of that was the catastrophic death of oyster spat off the northwest coast of America a few years back that was caused directly by ocean acidification. It cost industry a lot of money. Now, a fix was found to that. That problem, it's a creeping problem, and it will really damage our oceans, I think, if it's left unaddressed.
I want to dig deeper into your title, Atmosphere of Hope. There seems to be an atmosphere of gloom and doom now. The answer isn't fixing this problem. It's going to happen. We have to figure out how to adapt to it. You are making the case that things are kind of bad, but we're not there yet. We don't have to give up yet.
Well, that's right. I mean, look, the situation is serious. We're committed to 1.5 degrees of warming. We likely can't cut emissions fast enough to avoid 2. But we are making a start on cutting emissions. The Paris meeting is going to be important, and the action of individual people is hugely important. It's amazing what we've achieved, the billions of us working together over the last few years. But on top of that, we now have this new weapon we didn't know about, this third-way technology, which didn't even have a name before I wrote the book. You know, it wasn't really part of consideration. But if it really can draw down 40% of CO2, that's a conservative estimate, that we're putting up now by 2050, it will be a major part of our future. And, you know, 2050 is 35 years away, but think about living in 1915 and what 1950 must have looked like for those people driving their horse and buggies around. They couldn't have imagined a nuclear world or jet aircraft or communism covering half the country. In the same way, 2050 for us is unimaginable. But the potential is there. The technologies are in nascent form, but they're there. So I'm quite optimistic that we can overcome this problem with the right mix of investment in future technologies and driving down the burning of fossil fuel now as hard as we can.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much. Thanks all.
That's Tim Flannery. He's Australia's former chief climate commissioner. He's the author of the new book. It's called Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. We've been looking ahead at an international conference on climate change and carbon emissions. That's coming up at the end of this month.
And yes, the United Nations will be meeting in Paris, trying to hammer out a legally binding agreement for all of the nations on Earth.